To our topical series this morning, The Kingdom of God, this is part 22 of, I don't know how many to be honest, but we're going to look at how, where and what. This is the part 4 of the series so far. We're looking in these last couple of messages at life in the kingdom. Last episode we reviewed my critical assumption, and that was that, in my opinion, the early Christian view of an earthly kingdom, kiliasm, was probably the correct one. So we asked, who shall have life in the kingdom? It would seem that there's two types of people in the kingdom, that there's glorified believers and mortal survivors. And some survivors will be permitted entry based on their works, specifically their kindness to Christ's people. And that's what the sheep and goats judgment was all about. Now, what I should have said last time at the outset, what I should have said, was that thanks to almost 2 millennia of Hellenistic thought, we've been conditioned to think only of going to heaven when we die. And that's what most Christians think about. I'm going to go to heaven when I die. That's a very Greek concept. The Bible speaks of the physical resurrection of the dead, and all the historic creeds of the church confirm we will be raised from the dead. It's not about going to heaven when we die. That's just a waiting room. But as we try to take the prophetic scriptures of the future literally, it will seem unnatural to us and, well, maybe even a bit weird, you know? It may be that the non-literal view is correct. Or perhaps we're struggling against many, many centuries of groupthink. It's actually easy to take the Bible prophecy literally. You just read it and that's it, wherever it's reasonable to do so. But it's very difficult to actually put it together and make it work. It's easier just to spiritualize it. You remember Judaism's two messiahs? If you weren't here back when we looked at that, they looked at the prophetic pictures of a messiah who would suffer for his people, and a prophetic picture of a messiah who would be a conquering king. And they said, must be two different dudes, Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. No one could have figured out it'd be the one guy who would die and rise from the dead and come back. But at least they tried to make it work, literally. Anyway, we were obliged to ask, what's the point of an earthly kingdom? And I said, there are two reasons that I could think of. One, God don't make rubbish. So he'll fix it, even after we've screwed it up. And number two, to refute man's penchant for blaming others and or circumstances for their sin. You know, whatever it is, it's not my fault. And so, in the kingdom, despite living in a perfect environment with great health and longevity, mortal man will allow sin to raise its ugly head once more. And so God's judgment against mankind, the final judgment, great white throne, if you like, will be vindicated. But I actually thought of a third reason on Friday. How would you and I cope with being transported straight to eternity? It's not a long time, eternity. It's not a very long time. It's the complete absence of time. It's a totally different dimension. God created time. He lives outside time. That's eternity. Perhaps, and this is just a random thought, but perhaps we'll need an earthly kingdom of some kind in a glorified state to come to terms with the eternity that follows. Maybe that's what it'll take. It's all very speculative. I acknowledge that. Last episode concluded like this. We said, that's who, but as the great literary classic puts it, what shall we do, blue kangaroo? It's time to move on and find out. So today's slightly modified menu is, before we do what, let's take a look at how and where. So we'll start with how. How will these events come to pass? Well, we've seen before, in my opinion, we've got to watch for a false peace in the Middle East, probably in the Middle East. We've seen this scripture a number of times, 1 Thessalonians 5:3, for when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labour pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. Who's they? They is not we. We are not in darkness that this day should overtake us like a thief. The Jewish leaders made the same mistake before the Babylonian conquest, Jeremiah 6:13 and 14, and from the prophet even to the priest, Everyone deals falsely. They have also healed the hurt of my people slightly. Really? Slightly? The Hebrew expression al-nikala, it's hard to say, al-nikala, actually means superficially. They've done some superficial healing. How did they do that? By saying peace, peace, when there is no peace. History repeats. In the future, a false peace will usher in the time of Jacob's trouble, Daniel's 70th week. According to a whole bunch of Old Testament prophecies we looked at way back when, won't go over them again, an evil coalition will launch a war in which Israel will very nearly be defeated. And Israel's enemies will be from these four regions, from the west, from the south, from the east, and from the north. Coincidentally, Islamic strongholds in the area today. Now, if the Lord tarries for a couple of hundred years, who knows what they'll be? But if he returns in the near future, I can guarantee you that the evil coalition will be Islamic. Israel will cry out to Yeshua, who'll return with his saints and ensure victory for his penitent people. You will not see me again till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. What will happen to the aggressor nations? Well, I'll tell you. The Bible predicts total destruction of some nations: Syria, Saudi Arabia, southern Iraq, and most of Jordan. Three nations, it says, will suffer partial destruction, but survive. That's Egypt, northern Iraq, and northern Jordan, based on their ancient names, right? The people of Iran will be defeated and scattered, but will not be destroyed. Why is that, you know? Iran seems to be the most evil empire in the world today. I don't know the answer, but George has been there, I've been there. People are lovely. They really are very nice people. But the Ayatollahs and all the people who rule the country are a bunch of evil nutters. And not only that, it's the fastest growing church in the world is in Iran. There's not many of them, but it's really growing. Perhaps that's the reason. That's God's business, I guess, not mine. So that's how. What about where? See, until now, I have asserted that when the Lord returns, he will rule over the kingdom of God, a perfect planet. But a thought occurred to me. Can I prove that from the scriptures? Ooh. Here's a passage often cited to demonstrate that the world will be very different in the age to come. You know it, of course. It's Isaiah 11:6 and following. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child put his hand in the viper's den. So far, so good. But is this the whole world? Verse 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Is that the world, or is that just Jerusalem and its environs? The next bit isn't as helpful as it seems, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The word earth there, we've seen it before, the Hebrew word eretz, it means the earth, it seems straightforward. 681 times in my New King James in the Old Testament, translated as earth. It's the same word that's used in the very first verse of the Bible in counterpoint to the heavens. In the beginning, God created the heavens, Hashemayim, and the earth, Vehaeretz. There it is. However, it can also have a more limited meaning. Genesis chapter 2, verses, that should say 10 and 11, I'm sorry. Now a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it parted and became four riverheads. The name of the first is Pishon. It is the one which skirts the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. There's the word there, Eretz, land. And it's translated 2,503 times that way in the Old Testament. Kind of 4-1, meaning a more narrow piece of earth than the earth, if that makes any sense. And as we've seen in other studies, Haaretz is a term that is used especially in regard to the land of Israel. That's why modern Israel's oldest newspaper is Haaretz, the land, first published in June 1919. How did the Israelis have a national newspaper in the land of Israel 29 years before they allegedly stole it? Well, don't you worry about that. In modern Hebrew, it would be appropriate for this young lady to ask her friend how long she's been in Israel by saying, "Kama zman at ba'eretz," literally, "How much time are you in the land?" So do other texts speak unambiguously of global restoration, or do they also say Haaretz, the land? I'm acting here as my own devil's avocado, aren't I? It's the only Catholic fruit there is. The scriptures teach that Messiah's reign will be global over the whole world. For example, Daniel 7:14, "Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, all nations, all languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. And world rulers will submit to him." Psalm 72 verse 10, "The kings of Tarshish," which I think is Spain, isn't it? Of the isles will bring presents. "The kings of Sheba and Seba will offer gifts. Yes, all kings shall fall down before him. All nations shall serve him." But will the entire planet be fixed? Or will it be just the promised land? Never thought of it till the week, during the week. There is a Hebrew word for the world. It can mean the entire planet or all the land masses of the planet, you know, in distinction or in contrast to the seas. Here's that word in one of the Psalms, Psalm 50 verse 12. "If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all its fullness." That is the word tevel. Sounds easy enough to look for the appearance of this world tevel in a global restoration sense, but of course context is king, isn't it? Context is always king. It's often more important than the actual word used. And words come and go out of fashion over the centuries, don't they? And if you're the New Testament, you know, James might say big and Paul might say large. You can't make too much of it. But it's somewhere to start, right? So, do we have any uses of that word in that sense in the Old Testament? I could only find one example, sort of. Isaiah 27, verse 6. "Those who come, he shall cause to take root in Jacob. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world," tevel, "with fruit." But it's a little ambiguous. It could be saying the promised land will have such abundance that it will supply fruit to the whole world. Maybe. I think the only way we can resolve this is to consider the promised land in terms of its population. Is it possible for all of God's people, plus tribulation survivors, to fit within the promised land's borders? Genesis 15:18 states the promised land is from the Nile to the Euphrates. Here's one way to view it on a map. We've seen it before. Other representations of the promised land are significantly smaller. Some try to prove that the Genesis land promise was fulfilled in the past, in the days of Solomon, and God has finished now with Israel. So this is the smallest possible extent of the promised land that they can come up with. Now, you probably can't read the little legend there, but the green bit was the bit that they conquered under Joshua. It extends north a bit to a purple area. That was the land of Canaan at the time of the conquest. And the brown bit is the minimum size of the promised land. When it says the Nile will go to a tiny little tributary, where it says the Euphrates will find the southernmost point and we'll trim it back as close to the sea as we can. Even so, Solomon's kingdom never extended to the extreme west that this is marked, and about a third of the north were vassal states that were not occupied by Israel. Nevertheless, let's use it. This minimum promised land area is roughly 260,000 square kilometres. Present state of Israel, there it is there, is 22,000 square kilometres. I think you can fit three into Tasmania. So the minimum promised land is at least 10 times larger than Israel today. Israel's population, 9.6 million. If the land is restored to maximum productivity, it's reasonable to say that it could accommodate over 100 million people. And if it's the bigger, the full promised land, maybe 250 million, who knows? But wait, there's more. The book of Ezekiel prophesies the tribal allotment of land in the future kingdom as follows. It's different to the tribal allotment in the days of Joshua and all that. Here we go. Ezekiel 48, beginning at verse 1. From the northern border along the road to Hethlon, at the entrance of Hamath to Hazar Enan, the border of Damascus northward, in the direction of Hamath, there shall be one section for Dan, for the tribe of Dan, from its east side to its west side. By the border of Dan, from the east side to the west, one section for the tribe of Asher, and so on. You get the picture, right? When the tribal allotments are placed over the minimum area of Kingdom Israel, it's less than half. It's the yellow bits. The Jewish saved will live there, presumably. Who gets the rest of it? Saved Gentiles? So I don't think so, to be honest, because estimates do vary, but a reasonable guess is that 32 billion people have lived since the death of Messiah. It's a lot, isn't it? To put it another way, though, a quarter of all the people who have ever lived in the last 2,000 years are alive right now. It's another way to look at it. Four times the present world population. This is very rough, right?
It's 11:45.
Today, about 30% of the world professes to follow the Christian faith. That's us there. About 2.4 billion. If we use that 30% as a very, very rough guide, over the last 2,000 years, there would have lived approximately 10 billion Christians on Earth. Now, it's highly unlikely the world has always been 30% Christian. You know, maybe 100 years ago it was 40%, and maybe 1,900 years ago it was 5%. I don't know. But just for grins, right? Let's use it anyway. What portion of that 10 billion were genuinely saved? I don't know. That's something only God knows. You and I can never know that. But for grins, let's say 1 in 10 with a real McCoy, just for fun. That's still a billion Christians. And that's more than the population of present-day Europe. I don't think we'll all fit in the promised land. Not only that, but even if we could, the geometric progression of a long-lived mortal population would mean that we'd very soon run out of space. So I'm inclined to think it has to be global, but I can't prove it. Maybe it starts in the promised land and as time goes on, the rest of the world is unique. I have no idea. That's the best I can come up with. And that just leaves what? Will our world continue to function in all its modern and high-tech ways? Or will we return to a simpler lifestyle? I don't know. The scriptures were completed almost 2,000 years ago and are therefore silent on issues like the internet and things like that, obviously. Prophecies of the kingdom will be couched in words that made sense to the ancients, so we can't push them too far. Similarly, don't expect to find Papua New Guinea, Japan or Mauritius mentioned. In my opinion, this website is a bit silly, America and Bible prophecy. America isn't in Bible prophecy. There will be prophecies of mankind that apply to Americans and Australians and everyone else. But it doesn't say the, you know. I remember a website once where this guy was convinced it was Babylon. And he and all his cohorts moved to Canada to avoid living in, you know. But with that in mind, what does the future hold for us? As we've seen, there'll be a war in the Middle East. Psalm 46, verse 6. The nations raged, The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. Messiah will fight with Israel. Verse 7, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. And he will kick bottoms. Verse 8, come behold the works of the Lord who has made desolations in the earth. But this will be followed by genuine peace. Verse 9, he makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. I like the King James there. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. That sounds better, doesn't it? Is this global though or regional? Wars cease to the end of the earth. Eretz, or the land. Well, what will we do? Will we share in the Messiah's rule over the nations as per the promise to the overcomers in Thyatira? This is obviously very speculative. But do you fancy being the overlord of Meander Valley? I could think of worse places. Mind you, won't every place on earth be beautiful? What if it isn't? What if it's progressive? What if just the promised land is restored to begin with? Now, I'm not picking on Indians or anything, but it doesn't sound right, does it? Do the glorified and immortal believers in, say, Calcutta remain there? Nothing wrong with Indian believers. Please don't get me wrong. Just Calcutta isn't necessarily the nicest place to live. We've had lives of comparative luxury. Aye, you were lucky. Maybe we get the less idyllic bits. And the poor, the saved of India, get the nice areas. That'd be fair, wouldn't it? Then again, which is better? Immortality in a less salubrious part of the planet, or longevity with sin and death in the promised land? I'll eat curry, thank you. Speaking of the promised land, there will be some significant topographical changes in Jerusalem. Isaiah 2:2. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house, his temple, shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. What does that mean? Oops, it disappeared. But it says exalted implies high importance, doesn't it? But that's spin. The literal meaning of the word means something physical and is so used over 600 times in the Old Testament. It is nasa, it means to be lifted up, borne, carried, raised. I do wish they'd be consistent. But it's easier to say, look, it'll just be an important place, rather than what accompanies the thought of it being physically raised up. That's too hard. It's all spiritual. It's all done. What else? And all nations shall flow to it. As we've seen already, the word nations, goyim, means the Gentiles. Is this everybody in the world? Not necessarily. The next verse, many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, Jerusalem, to the house of the God of Jacob, the temple. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. How do we know this hasn't already been fulfilled? People all over the world follow Christ, don't they? Next verse, he will judge between nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Well, that's never happened. In chapter 4, the prophet seems to foretell the return of the Shekinah glory to Jerusalem. Verse 5, then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion, not necessarily Deloraine, and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering. It's hard to spiritualize that. In his prophecy of the Lord's return to Jerusalem, we saw this text, I think, a week or two ago, Zechariah predicts what appears to be a spectacular earthquake. Zechariah 14:4, and in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two, from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move towards the north, half of it towards the south. Verse 8, and in that day it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem. What are living waters? Oh, that's a spiritual thing. No, in Hebraic thought, living water is moving water. Like you see just across the other side of the park there, that's living water. It's not stagnant at any time of the year. Half of them toward the eastern sea, half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter, it shall occur, not like the Dead Sea. Verse 10, all the land shall be turned into a plain. It's like stretched out, flat, from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. And where's this soggy plain? Not in Spain. Not in Spain. Here's a map of Israel. I don't know if you can see the borders there, but it extends about 400 kilometres from its southern extremity to the northern tip, right? There's Jerusalem right there. And there's the plain from Geba to Rimmon. It's 180 kilometres, about 80 kilometres wide. It's a big plain. As a minimum, this new plain covers 15,000 square kilometres. And Jerusalem is elevated above its surrounds. Obviously, some people will live there. Jerusalem shall be raised up and inhabited in her place from Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate and the corner gate and from the Tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. Now, some of these landmarks are a bit obscure today, but the area described is fairly small. In fact, I get ahead of myself there. The slice of the promised land around Jerusalem is set apart. May not see it there, but that orange bit in the tribal allotments says holy portion. Okay? And the bit we just read is much smaller than that. That's much bigger than the elevated Temple Mount. Ezekiel prophesies a smaller area of land set apart within the holy portion for the Lord himself. Ezekiel 48:9, the district that you shall set apart for the Lord shall be 25,000 cubits in length and 10,000 in width. It's about four times the size of residential Deloraine. You know, not the farmland, just all the houses. Ezekiel chapters 40 to 42 give us the exact measurements of the future temple building. Here's a summary for you. Ezekiel 42:16-19, this is actually the outer court as well. He measured the east side with measuring rod, 500 rods. He measured the north side, 500 rods. The south side, 500 rods. The west side, 500 rods. 500 rods is about 1.5 kilometres. This photo shows the original Temple Mount in green. Can you see it with a big abomination on top of it? The future temple will cover the entire old city. It's about 55 acres. Which might explain why the region may require some spiritual modification. The new temple won't fit on the Temple Mount. How do you spiritualize it? I asked a pastor this once day, my old pastor a long time ago, and he said, well, this was an ideal thing. If the Jews hadn't rejected Jesus, they could have had all this. I think so. Why did God, who knows the end from the beginning, waste all that ink writing something down that was going to be pointless? But that still leaves a significant area outside the temple for the Lord. Who else shall live there? Ezekiel 48:11-12. It shall be for the priests of the sons of Zadok, who are sanctified, who have kept my charge, and who did not go astray when the children of Israel went astray, as the Levites went astray. And this district of land that is set apart shall be to them a thing most holy by the border of the Levites. So the Zadokite priests will live closest to the temple. Who are they? Keepers of the sacred word. Zadok was the high priest in the days of King David. He remained faithful after Absalom's palace coup. That's a picture of him there. His name was Zadok, which means righteous. And when Adonijah claimed the throne ahead of Solomon, when David wasn't even dead. Seen this in this series earlier, after the 2nd century BC defeat of Antiochus by the Maccabees, the temple priesthood became corrupt. It was during the Hasmonean era. Ironically, the false priests, the ones in bed with Rome, came from a group calling themselves Tzadikim, Sadducees, the righteous ones. They were calling themselves sons of Zadok, if you like, and they were anything but. They weren't even Levites, for crying out loud. You're fooling yourselves. We're living in a dictatorship. The sons of Zadok will live closest to the temple and minister before the Lord. The next bit is the Levites who will perform the sacrifices and so forth, but not be allowed into the Lord's presence, it says. Oops. It shall be for the priests of the sons of Zadok who are sanctified. Oh, I think I did that, didn't I? Sorry. Verse 13, opposite the border of the priests, the Levites shall have an area 25,000 cubits in length, 10,000 in width. Its entire length shall be 25,000 and its width 10,000. Is there anybody else out there? Verse 15, the 5,000 cubits in width that remain along the edge of the 25,000 shall be for general use by the city, for dwellings and common land, and the city shall be in the centre. So the holy portion is for those who perform duties in the temple, plus a bit of common land, probably a Macca's and a supermarket, something like that. With the Judahites and the Benjamites next closest to the holy bit. Those are the tribal divisions. You probably can't read them from there, but there are, what, 5 tribes south of Jerusalem and 7 tribes to the north. What will the purpose of the kingdom temple be? And will we be allowed or obliged to visit its holy precincts? Could that be you right there in that little yellow circle? Well, that's what we'll look at next time. What can we take away from today? At the Lord's return, the earth will be restored, but it might just begin with the promised land. Don't know. The redeemed might oversee different villages or cities or regions. I'll probably get a paddock with 2 moo cows in it. Thus saith the Lord. Whatever, I don't care. Jerusalem will undergo an extreme makeover. Temple staff will live nearest to their workplace, and the tribes of Israel will get at least half the promised land. Who knows with the rest? That's all, folks.